You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, welcome to Blogging Heads TV. You're watching Culturally Determined, and I'm your host, Arya Cohen-Wade. And my guest today is William Butler. Could you introduce yourself?
Yes, thanks, Arya. I'm William Butler. I'm the president of a digital agency called Butler, Inc. And besides that, I am a writer and a podcaster, sometimes a filmmaker, kind of like a restless creative sort, I suppose. And I follow technology and business topics very closely. Some literature, some Wikipedia, I think, are some topics we'll get to later. So there's a lot that fascinates me, and it is a joy to be invited back to talk about some of it.
Well, thanks for coming back on. You were on a little less than a year ago, I think.
Great.
And the topics we're going to cover today are the iPhone, the battle over unlocking an iPhone in the San Bernardino case,
mm-hmm.
And the larger issues this raises. You are an expert on Wikipedia, and there's been some turmoil at Wikipedia over the past couple weeks, and I want to ask you about that because I don't really know much about it. And we're also going to be talking about the novel Infinite Jest by David Foster Wallace. I actually have my copy.
Me too.
I know you can't see that, but... Oh, okay. Oh, so
is this the
I'm
new
holding
one?
Mine up.
Me too.
This is the paperback that came out in 97 or so. So
okay.
Is the original copy I read when I was in high school. So a
awesome.
Little teaser for the fans. So that'll be our final topic. So I want to... Oh, and we might also talk about the Apple Watch, because that's what
sure.
you're on. That's what we talked about the last time you were on, and...
Yes.
But you hadn't actually had the Apple Watch yet, so now you actually have had it. And
indeed.
I'll ask you whether it has changed your life.
Right, yeah.
So let's start with the San Bernardino case. So can you kind of lay out, for probably most people have at least heard something about this story.
Right.
Can you kind of lay out what's happened with this case?
Absolutely. Okay, so this starts in December of 2015. An American Muslim couple shot and killed 14 and injured 22, and then themselves were killed in a shootout with police afterward. And so in the investigation, local and federal investigators have been looking into the connections that they had, the communications that they had, and specifically on their, you know, mobile devices. And so at this point, the investigation is focused on the last of it. You know, they're both dead, so it's sort of... it's not really clear what's going to be found here. There's really no indication that they really had a connection to ISIS at all. But, you know, they want to look into it. And so what they have left is this iPhone that was owned by Syed Farouk. And it was actually owned by his employer, which was the San Bernardino County Department of Health. And so he also had two other devices that he destroyed. And this is the one that's left. Like, my guess would be if there's something interesting, it was on those other two that were destroyed. So like in a lot of cases, you know, Apple and other companies will work with law enforcement to recover information from devices. It's a fairly routine thing. But this is, and so the way that this conversation is being had in public, I think we need to be careful about how we talk about it. Because, like, for example, there was a Pew poll from a week or so ago that seemed to show that the American public supports by a slim majority opening up or unlocking the phone is the phrase they used. But the problem is that's not really what's going on here. The FBI is not coming to Apple and saying, can you unlock this phone? They are, they are saying that. And Apple is saying, well, we can't unlock this phone. Because over the last few years, Apple's encryption on its devices has become a lot stronger. You know, and it can be easy to be cynical about the motives of a company, you know, like Apple. But they've really aligned their brand message with your data being yours. You know, their profits come from hardware sales. And they want everybody to know that, you know, your data is not for sale to advertisers, like is routine for just about every other company in the tech space. And Tim Cook, the CEO of Apple, clearly believes in it. So they are going into federal court. FBI has filed a case in the, I think it's the U.S. District Court for the Central District of California. And, you know, the only thing it is sure about this is that it's going to go probably up to the Supreme Court. And another final clarification would be the Department of Justice really insists very, very desperately that this is just one time, just this one phone. They want Apple to create this special software a new, like a custom version of the operating system that will let them get into the phone without accidentally erasing all of the information. Because right now there is a trigger that if you enter 10 wrong passwords, then it will it'll make that information, it'll destroy the key, which will leave the information encrypted forever.
Standard on iPhones?
It's become increasingly the case. Well, this is an older version of the iPhone that Syed Farouk had. I forget which model it was, but it was iOS 7 or iOS 8. And it was a phone model from a couple of years ago, back before the security had gotten even tighter. Apple, a couple of years ago, decided we are going to make our encryption so strong that even we can't get into it. And if you send messages through, if you use iMessage, like on an iPhone or a Mac, Apple cannot get into that. This is a decision they've made some time ago. And, you know, they are making, this is sort of a new direction for them. And the FBI is using that against them a bit. You know, the fact that they have cooperated on other cases too, in cases where the you know, encryption wasn't so strong. I think on the assumption that, you know, you get the security you deserve. Like Farouk, I think, had a 4-digit passcode on his phone, which was the old standard. Recently, Apple has upped that to 6 digits as a default pass key to get into your phone. And if you want, you can even set up an alphanumeric password like most traditional like email passwords, for example.
Mm-hmm. I think you've laid that out really well. So I think I have a sense of where your sympathies lie in this case. Can you say who you think is in the right at this point, the Justice Department or Apple?
Oh, the Justice Department is so wrong. It's not even funny.
Go ahead. I'll just say I'm more sympathetic towards the Justice Department than I am towards Apple. But you know a lot more about this than me, so maybe you can just abuse me of my confusion. Why do you say why you think the Justice Department is wrong?
Okay. Well, so in the first place, the Justice Department's filing is I think they're lying. I think they're being deliberately untruthful. And if they're not, they're being very short-sighted about what this is going to mean for encryption going forward. It is simply not possible to create a version of the software that will always stay locked up inside Apple's, own server, own networks. If you unlock this one, there's no reason why Russia, China, other repressive regimes cannot ask Apple to do exactly the same thing. And so on top of that, it undermines security for everyone. And the Department of Justice is being very blithe in claiming that it won't do that. There is a writer who is an iOS forensic expert named Jonathan Zajarski, who has written extensively about this. And if maybe we'll include a link somewhere to what he's written. It's excellent, excellent. He's written many posts over the last 2 weeks that really explain what goes into the process of creating this special software. The Department of Justice makes it sound like, don't worry, Apple, you can keep it, it'll be fine. If you actually do want to use this software in recovering information from a phone and you need to take it to court, well, at that point, you actually have to get the software has to be, checked and written very carefully. It actually has to go to NIST, the National Institute for Standards and Technology, in order to get certified. If the defense wants to look at it, the defense has to get at it. So it's incredibly short-sighted to think that really would happen just the once. In fact, the Cyrus Vance, who is the DA in Manhattan, has at least 70 phones he said he would like to get unlocked using this exact same thing. And the Department of Justice itself has indicated it has 12 other phones it would like to get it would like to get opened in this manner. So there's all of that. And then on top of that, it's the long run picture of this is it's not just smartphones. It's also the devices that are coming along in the Internet of Things. Within, let's say, 5-10 years, pretty much everything in our home we think is going to have some kind of microprocessor and Wi-Fi connectivity. And so really, like, your refrigerator could be, you know, hacked by anybody if this was actually, if we're not allowed to have encryption, if encryption is deliberately disabled. I have more reasons, but are you convinced yet?
Well, I guess let me tell you how I think about this as, you know, a layperson, and why I'm more sympathetic to the FBI. Although you raised some excellent points. You know, the smartphone is, it's kind of like, okay, so it's kind of like Apple sold like a safe, you know, like a lockbox.
Yes.
To everyone in the country. And this lockbox does a ton of things. It, you know, you can make phone calls on it. You can take your photo with it. But there's some, you can also store information in this lockbox. Now, if this was an actual lockbox and a terrorist committed a crime and the lockbox was in the terrorist's house and the terrorist was dead, I don't think any of us would have an issue with a safe cracker coming in and opening the lockbox. But Apple is saying that, we sold millions of these lockboxes to everyone, and we can't open them all. We can't open them at all, because if we open one, every single lockbox that we have has been opened. Like, this just seems kind of crazy to me. Like, you know...
It's kind of crazy. I mean, it's science fiction, right?
You know, like, the government has... Like, it has a warrant. They should be able to search someone's house or property. I certainly don't think this should happen without a warrant, so that's we can agree on that, but like there's a legitimate public interest in finding out what the San Bernardino terrorists were up to and who they were talking to, and see if we can arrest those people if they had other conspirators. You know, I mean, this sound like I'm not fear-mongering, but like it's possible that there are other people who are kind of like a sleeper cell who he has contact with. And so if this information could be gotten through legal means, then I feel like there's a public interest in the government having that information. So what do you think about that?
I think you have to balance your different public interests and the public interest in knowing the specifics in this one particular case. And really in any particular law enforcement situation, there are times where you run up against the inability to access certain information. I might as well just add in here that they actually could have got into this phone if the law enforcement themselves hadn't screwed it up. Because the phone was owned by the San Bernardino County, they had access to the iCloud password. And they actually changed the iCloud password, thinking that would get them in. But once they had done that, then they actually, then the phone, like, won't let them back in. That's kind of... I don't know. That was an amusing part of it. But the more important thing is, though, you know, you talk about public interest. I think that if you look at the public interest of, you know, investigations in cases like this versus the security of absolutely everybody's phone and everybody's refrigerator, you know, for the future, these matter quite a bit more. I think that it's... And the other thing is, you know, for Apple to actually set this up, to actually carry this through, is quite extraordinary if they're going to do this. And this is actually where the legal case, as I understand, not being a lawyer, that a lot of this will turn on whether it's considered to be an undue burden on Apple to do this. Because in order to carry this out, they're not simply just, you know, they're writing a whole new program. Jonathan Zajarski, as I mentioned before, has outlined how what they need to do in the court's terms is create a new instrument. This is the process that requires going to NIST and requires, you know, extensive documentation at every step of the way. It cannot make any changes to the, you know, to the device that it's trying to recover information from. If it does make any changes, it needs to log all of those. In order to carry this out, Apple needs to basically create a whole new team that is, you know, the technical side, the legal side, so the whole new staff here. What it actually ends up doing is it creates this internal conflict of interest within Apple Computer, where they have two jobs to do. The first one is to build unbreakable encryption on their phones. And their second job is to break the encryption on their phones. I mean, this is absurdity.
And, yeah, so there's an absurdity there, for sure.
And the better they are at the first job, the harder is the second job. Yeah.
Right. I guess so. Going back to my metaphor of the lockbox,
Yes.
so it's like sorry, my cat is making a cameo appearance on
Right
this
on.
Mulligan's episode. It's like so the government is not asking Apple for the key to the lockbox. They're asking. They're saying there is no key to the lockbox. Apple, please build us a machine that will build a key to the lockbox. And Apple is saying that machine will therefore generate infinite keys that anyone can get access to the key and open any lockbox. So do I have that right?
Basically, right. I mean, please build us a key and build us a key that only works for this one particular phone. You can't actually do that. All you could do is you could build a key that would unlock a phone of this type and then cripple it so that it, only works in this one particular phone. Well, at that point, it would be trivially easy for somebody who gets that key to then, remove the portion that restricts it only to this one phone. So if they do write
Okay.
this, it is out there at some point in time. You just can't be certain. I would be certain that eventually something like that would leak. And besides,
Okay.
like the NSA. So the NSA actually, I think, has said that they kind of like don't care about this. Everybody kind of figures the NSA itself can get into any phones they want using zero-day exploits, which are undocumented. Like flaws in the software that haven't been publicized and are extraordinarily valuable, and like that's always a way that like you could get into this phone. But the FBI is trying to establish a precedent that would let them get into basically any phone that they wanted in the future, and do it have it be much easier for them to do so.
Okay, well, you've convinced me of a lot more of the danger of what Apple is being asked to do,
Right.
and what stops the Chinese or the Russian government from once this program has been built of
Right.
demanding it for their use. But isn't this like can't we blame this on Apple for like setting this system up to begin with for selling going back to my lockbox metaphor, which maybe I'm overextending at this point, selling the
Right.
lo a lockbox to 50 million people that can only be opened if we build the special machine that can, once we build it, it makes infinite keys.
I do think your lockbox analogy is an interesting one because. Right, your personal property, can be searched if done through proper procedures. And, to be clear, the FBI has the proper warrants, and the San Bernardino County has given permission to do this. But compare it to then you have like the Fifth Amendment, which prevents you from having to incriminate yourself by basically opening up your head to let the government, search and seize your thoughts. The interesting thing is,
Right.
though,
So if mind control was invented, it would have interesting implications for the Fifth Amendment and, criminal
right,
proceeding. But
totally.
we're not quite there yet. Apple,
No,
maybe iOS 10.0
no, no.
will have
Right.
that software, but we're not there yet.
But the iPhone is kind of like almost halfway in between, because we keep a lot of our thoughts on those phones, and they are and they're at this point where they are very nearly inaccessible. In the way that a person's brain is, we're not quite there yet, and it's certainly. I mean, so you ask about blaming Apple, and I mean, Apple didn't come up with the idea of cryptography, and they there's the best way I've heard about the best phrase I've heard about this lately is, you can't outlaw math. Like encryption is just math, and so it exists, and they are using it, and they are using it because it is very important. At times, for people to be able to communicate freely without being watched as they are doing so. And this is the eternal struggle of, the First Amendment and the concepts of free speech that people who will use these tools for bad as well as good. And to live in a free society, we have to allow that. I believe, especially as we are entering into a world where we do have devices and the potential for surveillance all around us. This is our last chance, perhaps, to forestall a world where we just are actually being surveilled all the time. Encryption, I submit, is necessary to keep us human. That's my
Okay,
view.
I love that
I should
phrase.
write that
But
down. Yeah.
yeah, I think that could be the title of your book, I think.
Yeah.
But I have to ask, like, what? Okay, so it's just, so encryption is basically just math. So isn't
Yeah.
so don't we think that someday some like hacker in, like Zimbabwe or something is
Yeah.
a bored teenager in his basement is going to be able to write this program that opens every Apple phone?
So here's where I'm not a computer scientist, not a nor a programmer either. I mean, let's just I'll concede in theory that's possible. Based on what I understand about how this particular math works, they're getting to a point where you just can't, where it would take far too long to guess the passwords. Like right now, the FBI is looking at, even with a four-digit key, with some of the like limitations built into the system, it could take like even without that 10 guess limit, it could take like 6 years to get through all of them. And so we don't know what the future holds, but in this case, I would say right now we're looking at potentially taking a very big risk of basically never having the promise of privacy again. And so
So do you
Apple is,
think that, sorry, do you think that that the Justice Department is wrong when it says Apple could write this program, or like
Well, are we
is
talking about
because
in
I think
this
Apple
particular
has at some
case?
point claimed that they can't, not only is this like not the right thing for them to do, it might be impossible. Is that accurate?
It's not impossible in the case of this one phone. It's using the older software that was
Okay.
it was less, less secure encryption. But they are certainly making phones now that are much harder to get into, and they're continuing to that basically they figure that by finally creating, encryption that they cannot break, that this is then, the FBI will just have to leave them alone. And so will other law enforcement, and like I say, like Russia and China, like those, regimes definitely are not the nicest to their people to, make an extreme understatement. And the potential for these devices to, be used for tyrannical purposes is scary. And I guess, you know what? You might flip this around and say, well, the future Syed Farooqs may use, the cover of the communication through these uncrackable devices for dark ends. And again, that's part of the trade-off where you have to look at what's preferable to have.
Okay, you haven't convinced me that I'm wrong, but I think you've made it more complicated for sure.
Okay.
I think we've I still kind of think, well, I don't know. I the viewers and the commenters can weigh in on what they think should happen in this case. Why don't we stay on the Apple topic
Sure.
and revisit the Apple Watch, which we talked about in
Yes.
an episode that we taped 10 or so months ago. So when we did that conversation, you had pre-ordered the Apple Watch. You didn't
Right.
have it yet, but you had played around with it a little bit. So I assume you have it now.
Indeed.
Has it revolutionized your life? Do you feel like you're a greater threat from Big Brother because you're actually wearing the device that the Justice Department wants to have the code
Right.
crack for on your wrist? I mean, what has the experience been of the Apple Watch?
Great question. So I guess I'm annoyed more often. If I had to think right now, what is the single most common emotion that I have at this thing, which is on my watch and I wear daily? And I do use for a number of things. Like I use it for workouts. I use it for messaging. I even will send text messages back through it. It can be useful for that. But it's demanding my attention all the time. Like I really would like to figure out how to tell it to only notify me about like emails from certain people. Maybe that can be done right now. I'm not really sure. And of course, the damn thing tells me to stand up on the 50-minute mark of every hour if I've been sitting. And this is
I
it.
assume that's something you told it to do. It's not just the
I
automatic
mean,
setting.
it comes in. It is part of the default settings that the exercise app wants you to stand for 12 hours of a day. But the way the sensor works, though, if you just stand up, it's not going to measure it. So what it really means is not just stand up. It means stand up and walk vigorously for 30 seconds, and then it will give you the hour. Because I have absolutely
Okay,
stood
well,
up and had it like not credit me for my damn hour. This is infuriating.
So maybe it's just our different perspectives, but this, what you just described, seems a lot creepier to me than the government having access to the cell phone. I don't know. Maybe it's. I mean, you're more of a conservative or libertarian than I am. Maybe I fear Apple's power more because I'm a good liberal, and you fear the government's power.
I'm a good libertarian. Let me clarify that. You and your good liberal.
Right. Didn't mean to cast aspersions on you. It's the automatic setting. Is you turn the thing on and then it starts wanting you to walk around every hour? I mean, that seems crazy.
You can take this thing off, Arye. You also don't have to buy it.
Right. But I mean, the next thing, it says, we've noticed that your hydration seems a little bit low. Gatorade makes a great beverage, and take a drink every once an hour. I mean,
oh, yeah, but Apple
just seems
That would happen on the Google version. You see, Google would cut a deal with advertiser, but Apple's already made its money by selling you the hardware, so that's less likely.
Right.
What they would do is they would
Google will give the watches away for free. But you get a buzzed once per hour saying that you need to eat an energy bar or something.
Yeah, conceptually, yes, this might happen, unless you turned it off.
So I guess these are just like. Right. So I guess these are kind of like two different versions of techno dystopia.
Yeah.
One in which the corporation controls everything, and one in which the government and evil governments around the world control
Orwell
everything.
Orwell versus the Huxley dilemma, which is the more likely dystopia.
Right. So that's almost a perfect segue that I feel, even though we didn't hear everything about the Apple Watch, I feel like we have to grab the segue to talk about Infinite Jest.
Absolutely. And I, by the way, am holding up. I got the 20th anniversary, even though I already own two or three copies of Infinite Jest, I had to get the 20th anniversary edition, because I had to get it, right?
Right. Okay. So Infinite Jest, I'm holding up now.
Yeah.
This is the copy I bought when I was a high schooler.
Awesome.
So here's a little inside scoop for Blogging Heads viewers, a little behind the scenes tip. I use some large books to put under my laptop so that the camera is elevated at my eye level. Mm. So I don't look like I have a double chin. And I usually use Infinite Jest because it's so big. In fact, I think it's 1,079 pages, if I recall it correct. Yes, it is 1,079 pages. So I'm using some different books today, but this is a famously long and difficult book. It came out in 1996, so it's been 20 years. David Foster Wallace wrote it. People probably know who he is because he killed himself in 2008. And they know that he wrote this very, very long book has 1,000 pages of footnotes, and it's the 20th anniversary. And I know that you are an Infinite Jest super fan, even more of a fan than I am. So what are your thoughts on the, 20 years since this crazy book came out?
I hadn't prepared for this. I'm very happy to know that it continues to be read, and that its legacy seems to have grown even from the 10th anniversary, which to me feels like it wasn't so long ago. Like you, I read the book back in college, and I read it a few years after it came out because I had a group of friends who were into it. And this is a book that I basically spent all summer and fall reading because, as you say, famously 10,079 pages, because every edition, both hardcover and paperback, is
1,079 pages, not 10,000. 1,079. It's almost 1,100 pages.
1,079. Well, sometimes it feels like it. It is very, very long.
Right.
It takes about till page 400 before it starts to come together, I think. A lot of people bail in those first few hundred pages. Talking with a friend on Friday who has read the novel, and he doesn't love it. He kind of asked me to defend it, and I had no trouble doing so. The prose, the language in the book, is both conversational and is just gorgeous. Like, Wallace could do things with sentences that I could never even begin to think about. I remember listening to a Bill Simmons, Malcolm Gladwell conversation about Wallace versus Jonathan Franzen, where, they both really liked the corrections, but they thought that, they could probably write the corrections if they really sat down and tried, whereas just, you have absolutely no shot at writing something as intricate and, dense and beautiful as Infinite Jest. So there's that. And then the character of Don Gately, who's the heart of the novel, Wallace's best creation, one of my favorite characters. I can read, and there's the early chapter where he breaks into a a mansion in Brookline, and you know, you remember this scene where he accidentally suffocates.
The toothbrush?
The toothbrush and the little French man with the cold who they tie up and who accidentally suffocates. And like this scene is just a great little like short story in itself. But there's actually one of the secrets of the novel is embedded within this section about, you know, a video cartridge that you just kind of read past and don't think about. In fact, you know, like the future of the book, because, you know, the book famously doesn't have an ending. But Wallace always maintained that if you did the math yourself, you could figure out what happens in the year following the book. And, you know, Aaron Swartz, this will be a good segue back to Wikipedia at some point, because Aaron Swartz, who also unfortunately committed suicide a couple of years ago, big Wikipedia editor. Aaron Swartz, I think he figured out, he was the only person who could figure out what David Foster Wallace meant when he said you could fill in the gaps of the year following the book. So weirdly enough, I feel like the other author of like the public's understanding of what the public should understand about this book is Aaron Swartz. He wrote this essay about, where he just argues based on textual evidence and logic what certain random threads from all across this 1,000-page book, how they add up, and it is just brilliant.
Wow, I've never heard of that. I have to read that. So let me just
send it to you.
So first, I'll just tell you my background with this book, and then we'll describe the plot a little bit, and then kind of encourage people who are intrigued to read it.
Yes.
So like I said, so this is the copy that is from 1997. So it's the paperback, not the hardcover. I started reading it. I'm almost positive when I was a freshman in high school.
Wow. Okay.
And I saw a reference, if I'm remembering this correctly, I saw a reference in Time Magazine, which I was a weird 14-year-old. I used to read Time Magazine every week. Mm-hmm. And their year-end best of. So it would have been in 96. And they mentioned this book, and they gave just like a one-sentence description of it. And it was like something about, you know, an entertainment that's so great that... So the part of the plot of the book is that there's this video cartridge, which is called Infinite Jest, and it's a movie. And it's so entertaining that you will watch it until you starve to death. You will cut your own fingers off to keep on watching it. And this is kind of like the MacGuffin, in some ways, of the book.
Exactly.
So I saw some summary of this. I was 14 years old. I was a little nerdy kid. and I was like, let me get this book. It sounds amazing. It sounds crazy. And then I got about 150 pages into it. And you know, I was 14 years old. And I had other stuff going on. So I stopped reading it. And then... for some reason, maybe like 6 months later, I was just like, well, maybe I should just give it another shot. I picked up right where I left off, mm-hmm. and I was able to finish it. I remember distinctly there was the one time I had a detention in school. I had this book, so we were all forced to sit in the cafeteria. I remember reading this book in the cafeteria in my high school. So I finished it, and you know, when I was 14 or 15, and you know, so people probably know that it famously has, you know, around 1,000... or maybe not 1,000. I guess it has 388 endnotes. So they're not footnotes; they're endnotes. Mm-hmm. So you need to be constantly. I'm holding it up to the camera so people can see. These are the endnotes. You need to be constantly. You need two bookmarks when you're reading this book. You need to be constantly flipping back and forth. Sometimes there's actually footnotes to the endnotes. There's stories that happen only in the endnotes. Some of the endnotes are just possibly made up, you know, like names of chemicals and stuff. But sometimes there's really information you need in the back. So Wallace basically, you know, like made us purposely difficult for readers. You know, he wanted you to struggle through this. The thing weighs like, you know, almost 2 pounds, probably maybe more. You have to be constantly flipping back and forth. So I remember I finished the book. I got really into Wallace. I read all of his other stuff. And I have since reread some of his stuff, especially his nonfiction, which I actually reread this past summer. Mm-hmm. But I've never dipped back I've dipped back into it, but I've never thought I want to reread Infinite Jest, because I just remember it was such a chore to be like flipping back and forth and carrying this thing around. And like, I remember like really loving it, but I just also didn't want to reread it. So I now, you know, 19 years older than I was when I first read it. Like, do you think I should give it another shot when there's, you know, the 10,000 books out there that I haven't read a single time?
Well, when you put it in context of other things you would like to read, I mean, you should read what you want to if you want to read other stuff. But if the question is considered just in isolation, is Infinite Jest worth a reread? I would say absolutely. So I read it in college, my first couple years of college, and then I reread it in the mid, well, in the late, you know, I picked it up again after he killed himself in 2008. And I've been a long-time member of an email list called Wallace L. I first joined it back in the 1990s when I was in college.
Right. That's funny because I think I was briefly a member of that. Uh-huh. I don't remember if I actually contributed, but it would have been like late 90s.
Sure.
And I think I was getting too many emails, so then I unsubscribed. But there was a website that's probably still around called the Howling Fantods that was kind of I remember reading that site and getting very into Wallace for a couple of years there, and I was on the mailing list, and then I kind of moved away from it. Also, all that stuff does that still exist, Wallace L?
It's active daily. I get emails. I kind of have them marked as read automatically because there are too many emails for me to actually pay attention to. I will kind of like go back and sift through and open up ones that look interesting. And I'm more of a lurker now, but I've met friends through that site. And a couple of years ago, I got this idea in my head that I wanted to create a project based around. I wanted to do some sort of a data visualization of Infinite Jest because I noticed that this 1,000-page book. There must be a data set to be found in here. And what I ended up doing was creating something I called the Infinite Atlas Project, which I might have mentioned on Blogging Heads in the past, where I, my aha moment was that led to this, the specifics of the project, was finding out that Wallace was hyper faithful to describing real locations, especially in Boston. The Boston of the novel is very similar to the one that he spent time in the late 80s and 1990s. And then when he would mention other locations throughout the U.S. and even beyond, he clearly was writing this book with an atlas at hand, because you could start to drop pins, on different cities. And then at the Boston level, you could drop pins on real street corners. And the father and son market, which is said to exist just down the hill from the Enfield Tennis Academy, is a real market called Father and Son that I have been to. And
maybe just briefly describe, although it's almost impossible to briefly describe the plot to this book. So there's multiple characters.
Yeah.
One of the main locations is a kind of a prep school, the Enfield Tennis Academy, a prep school for kids who are tennis, youthful tennis phenoms. Right. And Wallace himself was a similar person, although he did not attend a tennis academy. And then there's also so it takes place in the near future, although maybe it's, I think people have speculated that the years stop.
It was a couple years ago now. Like the actual year of GLAAD would have been 2014 or something like that.
Okay. So one of the conceits is that, the years now have, are named after products. Right. So there's the year of GLAAD, GLAAD. So it's kind of, it's ironic, but glad that the cleaning substance or whatever. There's the year of the dependent adult undergarment, right. And so it moves back and forth in time. There's all these absurd things happening, and there's all these abbreviations. So the year of the dependent adult undergarment starts being called just YDAU, and then there's a year that has a grammatical error in it. So it has that little bracket SIC closed bracket in it that is included every single time. So there's all these absurd things happening, but there's the Tennis Academy plot, there's a plot about drug addicts, there's a plot about this movie that is so absurdly entertaining that people will kill themselves to keep watching it, and it's also basically the plot of Hamlet, rewritten in weird ways. So, the Infinite Jest comes from
Hamlet.
The great...
Echoes of Hamlet.
Right, it comes from the gravedigger scene in Hamlet. I actually wrote my senior thesis in college partly about the gravedigger scene in Hamlet. Poor Yorick, fellow of Infinite Jest, most passing fancy or something like that. I knew him, Horatio. It's multifaceted work. So you made this. You made a map that people can buy, right? Like a physical map?
Yes, absolutely. Go to store.
We'll link to that. It's
cool. Yeah. store.boomerangs.com, you can find it.
So there's a lot of real life places in this book that you've mapped them. It's a really cool project. I encourage everyone to check out. So I just want to, I'll say one more thing about Infinite Jest, and you can say whatever else you want to say about it.
Yeah.
So I mentioned to you over email that I saw Wallace give a public reading It was maybe one of the last public appearances he gave before he killed himself.
Mm-hmm.
It was 2006 or 2007. He was the editor of the Best American Essays edition for that year, and so he was reading from that, or I guess he was reading some essays, but maybe he was signing copies of that. It was at the Strand Bookstore in New York, and so I waited like 2 hours to get my copy of I didn't have my Infinite Jest copy. I think I left it at home by accident. So what I did was that I bought a copy of because I was working like a crappy job at the time in New York City, so I bought a copy of Consider the Lobster from the Strand, got it signed, and then returned the copy that I had at home that I already read through.
Yeah.
And returned it to the Strand. But so I didn't have my Infinite Jest copy, so it's not signed. But I did get up, and people were having very, you know, Wallace, he suffered from depression. He was a drug addict and an alcoholic, so people have very emotional connections to his work.
He was a recovering drug addict and alcoholic. I just want to clarify. He stopped all substance use by the late 80s, early 90s. Yeah. Sorry.
Right, but he had a lifelong mental health struggles.
Yes, that's
true. Obviously he committed suicide in 2008. So people were sometimes having very long conversations with him when they got to the table to have their book signed. And so I got up there, I was very nervous. And so I asked him, so if you haven't read Infinite Jest and you want to read Infinite Jest, this is kind of a spoiler, but the book is so complicated that you'll probably forget about what I'm saying
right now.
Absolutely
true.
Actually do,
don't worry about this.
You make it all through. like you said, the book doesn't have a real ending, and it's unclear what's actually happening a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. So, but once you start rereading it, you see that there's a section about digging up where the main character's name is Hal in Candanza, is with a character who he never meets in the book, Don Gately, you mentioned, who's a drug addict and a convict, digging up the skull of his father who made this movie, Infinite Jest. And it's just, that's the only reference to it. And so I asked Wallace, what did this mean? Like, what's the real ending? And what he said to me was, I never really thought about it, or something to that effect. He's like, I never really had a real ending planned out. And this just so dumbfounded me that I didn't ask any more questions. I just shuffled off.
Yeah.
But it made me, Aaron Swartz maybe decoded the novel. There's all these people analyzing it. Mm-hmm. It made me wonder, looking back at it now, like, did Wallace just put all these clues in here to fuck with us? He clearly likes messing with his readers, as evidenced by the fact that, you have to turn back and forth over, 300 times when you're reading this book.
Right.
What he basically said was like, I didn't really have, there's no kind of like answer. Speaking of the key that unlocks the lockbox.
Very good.
What he was saying was that there, there was no key. So as someone who has thought about this book a lot more than I have, what do you think of that?
Well, you're certainly right that he wanted to create some, distress and confusion among his readers in order to kind of like, I think, knock them off kilter, so they were perhaps in a position to receive the ideas in the book, maybe a little more vulnerable state. And, the ideas of the book, like the core message of the book, I think of it as a variation on The Pursuit of Happiness. The book is really about the pursuit of escape from unhappiness. And some people do that through television and movies. So that's where the MacGuffin of the Infinite Jest movie comes up. Some people do so through drugs and alcohol. And that is something that Wallace himself did do and never talked about it in life. And yet, basically, you didn't talk too much about the halfway house where the drug and alcohol addicts are at. But it really is the paired twin location with the tennis academy, like there are contrasts to be drawn between, and they're physically situated right next to each other, although there's almost no interaction between them. Well, I mean, basically, I think that the strongest parts, I think everybody who reads the book would agree that the strongest parts of the novel are the halfway house stuff. And a lot of that is because it's basically reporting mislabeled. Intentionally, it's the truth put in public and intentionally mislabeled. And I think that's fascinating. It's basically, it might as well be the half invented memoirs of Wallace's time at a halfway house. And, Back to the Map Project.
Okay, that's really interesting.
Yeah. So hold on.
Go on.
Yeah. Well, one key thing here is that the the key to the mapping project that I did was finding out, with help from a friend, Matt Booker of the Wallace L, that there is a halfway house in Boston that Wallace actually attended, you know, is the basis of Ennett House. And in fact, it's actually at the same location. It's at the corner of Commonwealth and I'll forget the other name. Just like it said to be in the book, they basically wrote, he just got, it is mind boggling to me that nobody really put together the fact that, you know, he was in this halfway house for real, until after he died.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, so I've read all of Wallace's stuff, except I couldn't get through the book on Infinity because I never took calculus, so I gave up on that one halfway through. Mm-hmm. I read all of his other stuff, and I really think he was a better nonfiction writer than a fiction writer. And so if we look at the strongest parts of the book as being essentially memoir, you know, that really recasts, you know, how we view him, because he's known for writing this crazy novel that's 1,000 pages long, and I'm holding it up again, and it's very heavy, so I'm going to put it down. But if half of this was essentially nonfiction, and then the other half is this crazy thing that takes place in the future,
futuristic stuff, very silly, wheelchair assassins. You know, you have the extreme gravity of the lives of the addicts, and then you have the, you know, comic. You know,
there's like a Quebecois nationalist separatist movement where all the assassins are in wheelchairs, and there's just all sorts of it's kind of like Thomas Pynchon, you know, on acid, all sorts of craziness happening.
And their juxtaposition is part of what gives the novel this, that unique quality that's hard to explain. Because he, in some sense, and his friend Mark Costello, who lived with him in Boston and co-wrote a book with him, has said that. You know, he basically had his, a memoir of sorts of being in rehab. And then he also had this, you know, kind of postmodern, crazy story about international intrigue in this movie. And he kind of stitched them together. And so at one point in time, there were different projects. They became one. And that's why there's such radical shifts in tone. And mm-hmm. if you like that, then it, you know, it's. I think the combined effect is one of the great achievements in American literature, period. But it's not for everyone. That as all great literature is not for everyone, that's of course true with this one too.
Okay, so a ringing endorsement from you. I'll also endorse it. Like you said, if you're intrigued and you've heard about this book and you have 3 months to spare, I would recommend it. I think I'm going to prioritize rereading it, but you know, I was an English major in college and I never read Ulysses, so I'm gonna read Ulysses before I read Infinite Jest for a second time. But it's good. It's a good book. Do you want to talk about Wikipedia for a couple minutes before we wrap up?
Let's do. Yeah. So I know what you'll be asking about is there has been a lot of turmoil at the Wikimedia Foundation in San Francisco. It's a nonprofit that oversees Wikipedia. And
just go for it, because I basically I've heard about this story, and you are very involved in the Wikipedia world, and even were involved in this story in some way. So what is happening in the world of Wikipedia, Wikimedia, and people resigning and stuff like that?
So I've been involved as a journalist, basically writing about, because I write a blog called thewikipedian.net about goings on at Wikipedia, and I've written it almost for years and years now. I don't even know how long. So the story here is, there's so much backstory that I'd be afraid of going too far into the weeds. But basically, in December, a board member who was popular with the community, volunteer editors, was removed from the board. Nobody knew why. And he said it was because, basically, there was evidence of this secretive project that was being hatched back at the foundation by Jimmy Wales, in part, and also by Lila Tretikov, who until this week has been the executive director of the Wikimedia Foundation for about a year, for almost 2 years.
Jimmy Wales is the founder of Wikipedia?
Technically co-founder, but that's a little bit in dispute as well. But yeah.
Okay.
He's the most famous person. I people seem to know who that guy is. He's pretty famous, right. I think. But here's the thing. Jimmy Wales is not particularly popular with the Wikipedia community. And for good reason. In fact, there was this all through January and February. Jimmy Wales was loudly calling that board member a liar, saying that he was Wikipedia. So the board member claimed that Wikipedia had this, that the foundation had this secret project, and that secret project was something called the Knowledge Engine. And this was supposedly going to be a search engine that potentially, even crazy as it sounds, was supposed to maybe compete with Google. So why would Wikipedia want to build a search engine? So here's kind of the twisted logic. That in the last year, there's been some fear that Wikipedia's traffic is so dependent on Google that if Google ever decided to point away from Wikipedia, its traffic would crater, as has happened to Yelp and to other entities. You know, but Wikipedia is, it's a nonprofit, so like, why should it be so concerned about traffic? I would argue, like, it has an educational mission. And frankly, you know, what Google is doing is they are actually so dependent on Wikipedia for information as well that they even shut down their own open database project to use Wikipedia's open database project called Wikidata. So if anything, I mean, the two really are yoked together. So I question their concern about this. And I question
so they,
the logic.
So Wikimedia wants to build a nonprofit competitor to Google?
Transparent search engine. Well, at one point there was a plan to do so. As we know now, the project actually died a fairly quick death, but not fast enough. And in fact, sometime last year, they actually submitted a grant proposal to the Knight Foundation, which has given Wikipedia, or has given the Wikimedia Foundation a lot of money over time. They were asking for tens of millions of dollars to build this search engine. And the Knight Foundation basically patted them on the head and said, here's $250,000, go nuts. It was basically a polite, you know, screw you. But they have had a good relationship in the past. Basically, the leadership of Lila Tretikov really came under sharp focus, you know, right at the end of the year. But it was also known ahead of time that a lot of high-profile staffers, executives, people who were popular in the community who worked at the foundation had been leaving since late 2014 and all through 2015, and it really accelerated in the last month or two. Basically, morale at the foundation is atrocious, and it owes largely to Lila Tretikov's poor leadership that was not really too well known outside of the headquarters.
So how did this person end up in a leadership role?
Well, she was chosen after a very long executive search. You know, most people know of Jimmy Wales as the leader of Wikipedia, but he hasn't been its, you know, day-to-day leader for more than a decade. You know, once he realized he wasn't going to become a billionaire off of it, he turned it into the nonprofit foundation that we have today. And they found an executive director to run it. And that person for many years was someone named Sue Gardner, who maybe wasn't perfect entirely, but still has a fair bit of esteem within the community. Like, she kind of invented what it was to run the Wikimedia Foundation because it really grew up under her. However, mm-hmm. with her departure, they needed to find somebody who really ticked off a lot of boxes that were difficult to tick off. Like, you want management and you want, you know, the communication skills to go with it. You want someone with an open source background, somebody who's worked with community engagement, and somebody with a technical background. Honestly, Lila Tretikov really only has one of them. She has a technical background because she's a Silicon Valley sort. She worked at a company called Sugar CRM, which honestly I don't know too much about. And I think Sue Gardner definitely advocated for her. You know, Wikipedia itself has a real gender imbalance problem where far more men edit than women. So just from a political optics point of view, it's good to have a woman in charge. But they really do have a lot of really excellent female leaders, although I should note that a lot of those really excellent female leaders have also left the foundation within the last year. So unfortunately, like, basically the foundation is decimated. You don't see their work, but, and here's the thing, Wikipedia itself is still Wikipedia. The traffic is still huge. People are editing it, you know, every day. For the average volunteer editor, they might not even be aware that this is going on. But if you want to look at the long-term future of Wikipedia and figure out where is it going to be in 5-10 years' time, they really need to do that now because I don't think that you can put the Wikimedia Foundation back together in the same way. And there are challenges. So the question of how people will access information through the internet in 5-10 years' time. is absolutely a question worth having. Like Wikipedia is a creature of the web. It's technology from 15 years ago. And, you know, this is written for the desktop, written for a laptop, or, you know, for a browser. But we're using browsers less as we're going more toward apps, as we're using phones more than we're using desktop and laptop computers. So that's something that Wikipedia needs to figure out. And maybe this trauma will prompt the kind of discussion that they weren't going to have otherwise.
So why? So what did this woman resign because it was found out that she was lying, or what exactly is the scandal?
Well, I mean, the scandal in the first place is the scandal is how terrible she has been at rallying the employees and forming a coherent vision for the organization. And the symbol for this lack of organization has been the knowledge engine fiasco, where, you know, they went to Knight Foundation for all this money, got very little back. It's important to Wikipedia to be thought of well in fundraising circles, and, you know, this situation makes them look just incompetent. So that's a big problem. Mm-hmm. She looks incompetent. Like, I don't have all the details of... I do have friends who work there and have worked there, and I've heard, you know, anecdotal stories about, you know, how she's unpleasant to work with, that she just does not... Basically, communication skills, I would say, are the big issue. But there's also a lot I don't know still, because everyone there has a different story. But you know what you can do is you can go to Glass...
I have to say, there's something, if everyone has a Rashomon, like, you know, version of truth at the Wikimedia Foundation, there's something ironic about that.
I mean, that's really well said. It's really difficult to talk about Wikipedia as a coherent whole, because there's the foundation, then there's the community, there's this word Wikimedia, you know, that describes the whole movement. So Wikipedia is at one time both intensely, you know, very familiar, ubiquitous, and it's also hard, it's also ineffable. It's also impossible to wrap your head around, which is possibly why I've spent, you know, I'll be coming up on my 10th anniversary as an editor this summer. And I think maybe this, you know, epistemological question is why I found it so fascinating.
Huh, that's interesting. You know, I don't want to toot my own horn here, but okay. I also read Infinite Jest before you did. I actually also edited Wikipedia before you did.
Oh, my goodness.
Someone I went to college with knew about Wikipedia because he was a computer science major, and I won't name him, but he is currently in charge of founded a company that... has been valued in the billions of dollars, but he did his senior research project on wikis, and no one, this was in late 2004 or early 2005, he did a presentation on it, and no one had ever heard of it before, so I was like, wow, this thing is really cool. So I went in and I created the page for the high school that I went to. I created a couple pages for Philip Roth novels, so I was really into Philip Roth at that point. And I went back and checked just actually a week or so ago, and some of the articles that what I wrote for some of the Philip Roth novels where I created the page, that text still exists,
cool.
You know, 11 or so years later. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like this crazy path dependency that I wrote stuff when I was 22 years old, defining, you know, giving plot synopses for Philip Roth novels. And a lot of that is still in the Wikipedia articles, which it used to be the joke that kind of like, you know, don't trust anything on Wikipedia, but I think Wikipedia has really become much, much more trustworthy than almost anything else you see on the internet. And if, you know, someone tries to insert something that is incorrect, the legion of editors there will quickly go in and correct it. So, you know, it's a very important thing. It's become almost like a, you know,
public utility
resource. Yeah. There's just all these different audiences that use it. Like, you know, anything you Google, pretty much any person or event or proper noun, the Wikipedia entry will be one of the first ones on Google.
I could tie this back to Apple. You know, Apple embeds it into their Safari operating system. If you search for something on like an iPhone, it will try to return you a Wikipedia entry before it has to give you like a Google search result.
Uh-huh. So what happens at Wikipedia is important for sure. And as you clearly believe, but the how many people work at the foundation? It's only like, it's less than 100, right?
It's more than 100, but that's still very small compared to the tens of thousands of editors, right?
Right. So there's all these different constituencies that, you know, whoever is leading this thing needs to appeal to. The people who work at the foundation, the people who donate money, the people who are donate their time through being freelance editors, and kind of like the public interest of having this, you know, this resource, this knowledge out there. So it seems like a hard job. And clearly this woman just was not doing a very good job. But
right, that's true. It is.
What master is this person serving, you know?
Yeah. Technically, the Board of Trustees, and they're the ones that ultimately had to. I mean, she resigned, but, you know, everybody, she was allowed to resign, I think, as everybody understands. And it is a hard job. Like I said, Sue Gardner invented it, basically, because no one had done this before. I think that it's not hard to think that she might have screwed up in some ways, but it seems like she just completely lost control of the ship. And by the end, you almost had to feel bad for her, the way that employees were talking openly in public about her refusal to, you know, give a coherent explanation for what happened around the knowledge engine. Like the Tuesday before she resigned, she wrote this blog post that was supposed to be like behind the scenes explaining what happened. And the blog post was, again, just like obscure. It was, you know, obfuscating. It was PR speak. It was spin, and it was not very enlightening at all. And in the comments section underneath that terrible blog post, actual currently employed engineers of the Wikimedia Foundation, like, hashed out what they thought really was going on. And at that point, you really have to just remove the person in charge, whether they are the worst person in the world or not. They clearly are not doing what they need to as a leader. You just need a change at that point. And that's where Wikipedia got to. It's not like these new problems were new, but they eventually become fatal.
Mm-hmm. Now, will you issue a Sherman-esque declaration that if selected, you will not run, and if elected, you will not serve as president of the Wikimedia Foundation?
You know, I also happen to be a consultant where I help companies, brands, organizations, people work collaboratively with the Wikipedia community to improve topics. I am a disclosed paid editor, which even though I am disclosed and very open about the work that we do, is still kind of a controversial thing at Wikipedia. So I would never, ever get the support to do that.
Okay. that's too bad.
Yeah. It's not my fate.
Okay. Is there anyone, maybe the final question, is there anyone who you think would be good in this role? Like, should it be someone who is like a grand old man type person?
You know what there
respects,
is.
Or should it be like an engineer or who should it be?
There actually is someone, and he'll kill me for saying this, but this is Andrew Lee, who I have appeared on Blogging Heads to talk Wikipedia in the past. You know, he's been around since the first couple of years. He wrote a book called The Wikipedia Revolution back in the late 2000s. Mm-hmm. He's very well, kind of everybody knows him and everybody likes him. He's very knowledgeable, very astute thinker, and, you know, full disclosure, is a friend of mine. We have given joint presentations about the, you know, paid editing issues on Wikipedia and other things as well. I think that he probably would get a lot of support from the community if he wanted to do it. He does not want to do it. He is a professor. He's a journalism professor at American University here in DC, where I'm at. And, you know, he's got a family, he's got young kids, and he just moved back to DC where he grew up after, having lived in Los Angeles and Hong Kong. He didn't want to go out there and deal with that. But I do think he is, somebody that people listen to a lot. So, especially behind the scenes, he writes occasionally for like the New York Times or Washington Post about Wikipedia. He's doing perfectly well in his job, you know, as kind of sage counsel for Wikipedia volunteers and Wikimedia staffers. But finding the next executive director, like right now, they're going to have to find an interim, and they could go internal, they might go external. Nobody, I have not heard anything, so I don't have any, you know, specific information on what they're likely to do. But it'll be hard. It was hard to find. It took way too long to find Lila Tretikov, and then she wasn't any good. Here's what I would actually argue, and the next thing I might write for my site about what Wikimedia Foundation should do is they should not try to put it back together as this large organization. They should actually spin off certain functions that they currently do, have those able to operate as independent nonprofits themselves, focused on specific mission-critical aspects of the whole Wikimedia movement. And I don't know if that's likely to happen. You know, right now, it certainly makes sense that, you know, every year they run those fundraising banners, and those fundraising banners deliver. Wikipedia, although the Wikimedia, again, I keep doing it, Wikimedia. The Wikimedia Foundation, you know, I think they had $50 million banked last time I checked. People are always surprised how much money they have. The only thing is, they also spend all of it. Like, they're basically a half technology and half grant making organization. And, you know, they're obviously the technology side has become controversial with this knowledge engine. I would also argue that their grant making isn't as effective as it could be, because they tend to fund smaller projects that, you know, because Wikipedia's volunteer ethos, you know, these grants are given to people who are oftentimes doing things on a volunteer basis. And I think that inhibits Wikipedia's ability to, you know, to go in strong new directions as this, you know, everybody from Rashomon tries to tell a story, you know, everybody from Rashomon tries to, you know, build a software product. It might have a lot of problems. Yeah. It's not just that it's like a big ship that takes forever to steer. Nobody can agree on exactly which direction to go. And that's part of the problem too.
Yeah, I wonder if that's kind of embedded in the, you know, thing they've set up, because it's inherently collaborative. And then, but you know,
yeah.
You need someone saying yes or no in the end. Is there like a Trump-like insurgent populist candidate out there who's like saying they're gonna, you know, make Wikipedia great again or something like that?
That's a great question, but I don't think there is. That's now I'm going to be on the lookout. Is there somebody who secretly is that, and I haven't realized yet?
Okay, so maybe there's a niche out there for an insurgent
for a Donald Trump
fantasy.
Type. Lord, I hope not.
I'm interested in Donald Trump's Wikipedia page. What is actually on there? So we've probably reached the end of our time. Bill, thanks so much for coming on. We'll include links, including you did a talk with Andrew Lee on Blogging Heads about 2 years or so ago.
We did
so
a couple
we'll
of them.
To that.
Yeah.
And any other articles that we mentioned will be linked below, and then you can there'll be a link to buy a copy of Vivid Jest on Amazon.com, and which we encourage you to do if listen to this piqued your interest.
And of course, you got to check out the Infinite Map limited edition print at shop.butlerinc.com. I got the
right. So there'll be a link to that as well. So you'll read the book. Yes. And then you'll look over your fireplace and you'll see an empty spot there, and you'll think, what can I put there that, you know, would honor this 3 months I just spent reading this book? And you'll want to check out this really cool map that you made. So Bill, thanks for coming on with me, and thanks to the Blogging Heads viewers, and we'll see you again next time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.